All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're going to be looking at this Seventh Circuit case, United States v. Thornton. It's a really interesting case about attempted bank robbery and kind of the nuances of what that really means. And it's not just some, you know, academic exercise either. It actually highlights this like fundamental tension in legal interpretation, and it's caused a split among the federal courts.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at its core, you know, this whole Thornton case, it comes down to this one little word, attempt, and its impact on the requirement of intimidation in like the federal bank robbery statute. Thornton's attempted bank robbery conviction, it got overturned because the Seventh Circuit basically said the prosecution didn't actually prove actual intimidation.
Yeah.
You know, so the big question we're going to be digging into today is like, why is there this huge legal distinction between like trying to intimidate someone and actually intimidating them?
That's exactly right. So in today's deep dive, we're going to, you know, lay out the specifics of Thornton's actions. We're going to get like super granular with the language of 18 U.S.C. sections 2113A. That's the actual statute in question. And then we're going to explore the Seventh Circuit's reasoning in detail. And then finally, we're going to kind of zoom out and look at the broader implications, including this like fascinating disagreement between the different courts of appeals, you know, the circuit split.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So to start, let's set the scene, you know, the background for this case.
Okay. So Walter Thornton, our main character in this legal drama, wasn't like brand new to the bank robbery scene. He actually had a prior conviction up in Canada. So flash forward to September 2005, he links up with this guy, Tremaine Moore, to plan a robbery of a bank one branch. And like, they were pretty serious about it. They got disguises, a gun, they even got blueprints of the bank, you know, the whole nine yards.
Wow. So definitely not just like a spur of the moment kind of thing. So then on September 26, 2005, Thornton, he's disguised. Mm-hmm. He's carrying a duffel bag with the gun in it, and he's in the bank one parking lot. And this is where things get really interesting. He runs into this guy, Jaime Contreras. But here's the twist. Contreras wasn't a bank employee.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, Thornton just, like, bolts, takes off. He never even goes into the bank, doesn't make any demands, just gone.
So did anyone see him take off?
Well, yeah, actually. This witness, Olga Salazar, she sees them taking off in their getaway car. It was Moore behind the wheel. And crucially, she gets their license plate number, which, you know, turned out to be like a key piece of evidence later on.
Oh, that's huge. So even though he didn't get into the bank, I'm guessing they still found enough evidence to, you know, tie them to this whole thing.
Yeah, you're right. Once the police get involved, they find a ton of evidence. They search Thornton's car and the shoe warehouse where both he and Moore worked. And they found the gun, the disguises they were going to use for the robbery, and those bank blueprints. So, like, even though the actual robbery never went down, their intentions were pretty clear.
Right. And that's what leads to the whole legal battle, right?
Exactly. So they hit Thorne with two pretty serious federal charges. 18 U.S.C. Section 2113A, which deals with attempted bank robbery, and Section 924C for having a gun while committing a violent crime. So he goes to trial. The jury finds him guilty on both counts, and the district court, they basically uphold the verdict, even after Thornton tries to get it tossed.
Mm.
He ends up with a 132-month prison sentence, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at. And that's what takes us to the appeal of the Seventh Circuit.
Makes sense. So now that we've got the backstory, let's get into, like, the real legal nitty-gritty here. 18 U.S.C. Section 2113A. Can you, like, break that down for us?
Yeah, definitely. So 18 U.S.C. Section 2113A, it basically has two parts, or two prongs, as the lawyers like to say. The first one makes it a federal crime to take, or even just try to take, bank property by force and violence, or by intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the specific part of the statute that they went after Thornton with.
Okay, so force and violence or intimidation. Got it.
Right. Now, the second part of the statute, it's about entering a bank with intent to commit in such bank, any felony affecting such bank, or any larceny. What's important here is that this second part doesn't even mention force, violence, or intimidation at all.
So there's the difference. So if the second part doesn't need proof of intimidation, what was Thornton's beef with the first part during his appeal?
Well, the big legal question was, did the government actually have to prove that Thornton used actual force, violence, or intimidation to convict him of attempted bank robbery under that first part? Thornton's argument was pretty straightforward. He said, okay,
yeah,
the prosecution showed that I wanted to intimidate people, but they didn't prove that I actually did intimidate anyone.
Nice.
Since they charged him under the part of the statute that specifically talks about intimidation, he said, hey, they didn't prove that part.
So it all boils down to this little word, attempt, and how it fits in with force and violence or by intimidation. Did the prosecution have to prove that he tried to take something using intimidation, or was just the intent to intimidate enough?
Exactly. And that takes us to how the Seventh Circuit looked at it.
So how did they rule?
Well, the Seventh Circuit's majority opinion, they went with a super strict, literal interpretation of the law, what they call a textualist approach. They basically zeroed in on the exact words of the statute. Their main finding, the heart of their decision, was this. The attempt language relates only to the taking and not to the intimidation.
Whoa, that's pretty dense. Can we, like, unpack that a bit? What does that actually mean?
Sure. So what the court's saying is, even if the robbery doesn't actually happen, you know, because it's an attempt, the government still has to prove that actual force or intimidation happened. The word attempt only applies to the actual taking of the money, not to the elements of force or intimidation. Like, you can't attempt to intimidate someone. You either do it or you don't.
Oh, I get it. So it's not enough to just show that he was planning to intimidate. They have to show that he actually scared someone.
Exactly. And to kind of illustrate this, the court compared Thornton's case to other attempted bank robberies where courts did find intimidation. Think of cases where someone walks into a bank and hands the teller a note saying they have a gun and demanding money. Even if no money changes hands, that action right there in the bank directed at bank employees, that's usually enough to prove intimidation.
Right. Because in those cases, you have a clear direct threat happening inside the bank.
Yeah. But in Thornton's case, remember, he never even stepped foot in the bank. He never actually interacted with any bank employees in a threatening way. His encounter was outside in the parking lot with someone who wasn't even working at the bank.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
So the Seventh Circuit, they took a good hard look at the evidence against Thornton. And they agreed that, yeah, his actions like wearing a disguise and hiding a gun, those showed that he intended to rob the bank and probably intended to scare people inside. But they said that those actions, because they happened outside the bank and weren't directed at bank employees in a threatening way, those didn't meet the legal definition of actual force, violence, or intimidation.
So the Seventh Circuit basically said he didn't actually intimidate anyone, and because of that, the whole attempted bank robbery conviction went out the window. And what about that firearm charge, the one under Section 924C?
Oh yeah, that one got tossed out too. The Section 924C charge, it hinged on the attempted bank robbery being considered a crime of violence. But since the Seventh Circuit said that in Thornton's case it wasn't a crime of violence because he didn't actually use force or intimidation, the gun charge couldn't stand either. They were, like, connected.
Interesting. So looking at the bigger picture, what does this Thornton ruling mean for prosecutors? How does this change things?
Well, it means prosecutors in the Seventh Circuit, and maybe even in other places that follow this ruling, they're going to have to be a lot more careful about which part of Section 2113A they use to charge someone with attempted bank robbery. If they go with that first part, the one about intimidation, they got to be ready to show that actual force, violence, or intimidation happened, even if the robbery didn't actually go down. Just having the intention to intimidate isn't enough anymore. So we might see more prosecutors going with that second part of the statute, the one about entering a bank with the intent to commit a felony. That one doesn't require proving intimidation.
That's a good point. And for all those law students out there, think about how that impacts the burden of proof and what kind of evidence you need for each part of the statute. It's not just theoretical. It changes how these cases are actually prosecuted.
Yeah, for sure. It can really change how prosecutors approach these kinds of cases.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what about the role of the jury in all this? What does Thornton mean for how juries are instructed?
Well, Thornton shows how incredibly important clear and accurate jury instructions are. Judges have to make sure that when a jury is considering attempted bank robbery under that first part of the statute, they understand that the word attempt doesn't change the fact that they have to find actual force, violence, or intimidation. The jury instructions in Thornton's case, they weren't good enough. They didn't make it super clear that there had to be actual intimidation, and that might be part of why the jury convicted him based just on his intent.
Right. The jury instructions need to be super clear. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that the Thornton decision created this split between the circuits. Why is that such a big deal, and what might happen because of it?
It's a huge deal. You see, the Seventh Circuit's interpretation in Thornton, it's not the standard across the board. Other federal courts, like the Ninth Circuit, they've interpreted Section 2113 a bit differently. They've basically said that trying to intimidate someone, even if you don't succeed, can still be enough to nail you under that first part of the statute.
Oh, wow. So, like, different rules in different parts of the country.
Right. And that means that theoretically, the exact same actions in an attempted bank robbery could lead to different legal outcomes depending on which circuit you're in. That kind of inconsistency, it doesn't exactly scream fairness. It's a pretty big deal for the federal justice system. And when you have this kind of disagreement between the circuits, it's very likely that the Supreme Court will step in to settle the issue and make sure the laws apply the same way everywhere.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the Supreme Court might have to step in and make a final decision. Okay, so let's play this out a little bit. What if Thornton had gone into the bank, gun still hidden, but hadn't actually said any threats or shown the gun? Would that be enough to prove intimidation under what the Seventh Circuit said?
Ooh, it's a good question. And it gets into another area where different courts don't always agree. Based on what the Seventh Circuit said in Thornton, just being in a bank with a hidden gun, that might not be enough to count as intimidation, especially if you don't do anything threatening or say anything threatening. The main thing would be whether Thornton's actions inside the bank, even without showing the gun, would have made the bank employees reasonably afraid that they were in danger.
I see. So it comes down to whether they actually felt threatened.
Exactly. But, you know, other circuits might see it differently. They might say that walking into a bank with the intention to rob it while packing a gun, that creates a threatening situation automatically, even if the gun stays hidden. So the answer to your question really depends on the specifics of how he acted in the bank and how that particular court interprets the law. It's a good example of how these cases can get really complex and fact-specific.
So the key takeaway from Thornton, the thing to remember, is how the Seventh Circuit drew a clear line between trying to intimidate someone, which they said wasn't enough in this case, and actually intimidating someone, which is what the first part of Section 2113A requires for a conviction, even if the robbery itself doesn't actually happen. You can't just intend to intimidate someone. You got to actually do something that intimidates them.
Exactly. The government has to show that there was an action that caused someone to feel intimidated, even if the robbery never happened. Just thinking about it isn't enough, no matter how obvious it seems.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I think we've had a really insightful deep dive into United States v. Thornton today. It's kind of amazing how a single word, like attempt, can have such a huge impact on the law and lead to such a big disagreement between different courts.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the Seventh Circuit's main takeaway, the thing they really emphasize, is that attempted bank robbery under that first part of Section 2113A, it has to involve actual force, violence, or intimidation, not just the attempt to use them. That's a huge point for anyone trying to really understand this part of criminal law.
And for any law students out there, Thornton is a perfect example of how complex and nuanced statutory interpretation can be. It shows you how the exact wording of a law and a good understanding of how the different parts of a law work together are super important in criminal law. Pay attention to how the court really digs into the language and explains its reasoning.
For sure. It makes us think about what this circuit split means in the real world. How might these different interpretations of attempted bank robbery in different parts of the country affect things like what charges prosecutors bring, plea deals, and what happens in similar cases? And what does it tell us about how federal criminal law is constantly changing and the role of those appeals courts in shaping how the law is used and understood? It's a case that's still generating discussion and debate, and it shows us that legal interpretation is this, like, living, breathing thing.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating case. All right, well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into United States v. Thornton. Until next time.